This much is surely true. We live in a world that teems with life. Now, picture that. Exemplify it. Perhaps we imagine the rainforest, steamy and dense, loud with life, life that's presumed to be concealed when it's not readily apparent. Think maybe of buzzing meadows where flowers are heaped with wandering bees and rabbits go bounding in and out of sight, crickets chirp, birds of prey wheel overhead. Or do you imagine the reefs beneath the waves, full of flickering colour, creatures of all shapes and sizes shoaling about, peeking out of anemone clusters? Let's picture this instead. A landscape of stunted trees, sparse vegetation. The soil is thinly laid upon limestone. There's something of the prairie about it, a place of grass and rock and lichen and moss. There are flowers. They stand pale and pretty and thin-stalked. It's a landscape you might take on first examination to be uninspiring. And you suppose that this podcast will go on to affirm that idea, that this landscape, the Alvar landscape, is dry and dead and sparse. Or am I predictably about to rhapsodise about the prettiness of the Alvar, about quite how deeply one can consider and examine such a place, and therefore quite how much thought and examination can really be expended on any place? This is, after all, an invertebrate podcast, and any fan of invertebrate life is keenly aware that there's value and beauty and excitement to be found in places where we are not culturally predisposed to find it. Today, we're looking for spiders. We will learn about the Alvar landscape with spiders held in mind, and we'll learn about spiders whilst holding the Alvar in mind. Fresh perspectives, good fun. And now suddenly the audio quality has changed. You don't need to worry about it. It's just a thing. Let's move on. Let's get amongst the Alvar then. Let's clarify what an Alvar is and search for spiders. The fantastic Gillian Sokorowski-Legree will be our guide. In this episode, you'll learn about a landscape with which you might be unfamiliar. Think about spiders in a fresh light, considering new ideas and angles, and also have some insight into what it means to study and examine. I think it's fascinating, and I can't wait for you to enjoy it. And so I demand you do, as we learn about spiders of Alvars with Gillian Sokorowski-Legree. So today I'm very pleased to say I'm joined by Gillian Kurowski, an arachnologist and science communicator. How are you today?
I am wonderful. It's a wonderful 10 a.m. in my basement. I'm getting all of the sun with none of these windows.
And your basement is, I was going to say full of cockroaches. That makes it sound wrong. But your basement is full of, like, there's tanks of various creatures scuttling about and doing their thing, right?
It's full of cockroaches, tarantulas, jumping spiders, scorpions. I've got a whip scorpion. They're not free range, although I do know people who have free range jumping spiders, but they
don't have
like cats or dogs or anything like that. I have two cats.
You'd think so. How do they feel about the tanks?
They love watching feeding time with the cockroaches. Yesterday, I dumped a bunch of fruits and veggies in my cockroach enclosures. And one of my favorite sounds, this would be a great ASMR stream for you, is just hearing the sound of cockroaches munching on fruits and veggies. It's one of my favorite sounds.
Do you know the sentences that you hear that you never expect to hear in your life when you start doing a kind of invertebrate podcast? And that's high on the list. But Gillian, you know, I can see that you are, I mentioned, arachnologist, science communicator, someone who keeps invertebrates and keep be the right word?
Invertebrate keeper, yeah, just like a zookeeper kind of deal.
Can you tell me a little bit about your kind of history with invertebrates and your personal and professional relationship with them?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, one of my favorite photos of me is I'm probably about 4 years old. I'm at the Henry Dorley Zoo in Omaha, and I'm holding a Madagascar hissing cockroach. And that was, you know, that's not something I remember as an adult. But that image would become full circle as I joined the Iowa State University Insect Zoo upon entering as a freshman in college. And that was 2016, November of 2016. And in that position, my job was to take care of over 100 different species of exotic arthropods. So from cockroaches to mantids to Malaysian walking sticks the size of my arm to tarantulas, scorpions, you name it, we had it. And so not only was I their keeper, but I went around the state of Iowa to teach people about these animals. So I packed this van full of live bugs. I know I said if the van ever crashed, I was running. but that was the most, I think, influential experience for me, because that's when I had told myself that this is my future, working with invertebrates. I loved it so much because it was something that was so new and interesting to people, because I think most people don't willingly interact at close proximity with invertebrates. Mm-hmm. So that was really exciting for me to introduce people to this world that they might never be exposed to otherwise.
Talking about the fact that people aren't exposed much to invertebrates, and people, they often, their behaviors are unusual or strange to people. Having worked with that many invertebrates, and having worked closely with that many invertebrates, and having studied invertebrates, and I don't mean this in a negative way per se, but has that mystique fallen away? Like, are they just any other animal? Have they become run of the mill, or is there still a strangeness to that?
Absolutely not. My advisor in my master's program, one of the best things he's ever said to me was that even the most common spider can spark curiosity in people. And I think that's mm-hmm. really beautiful, because it does that to me too, to this day. Even the most common spiders, I think, wow, how are you here? What brought you here? How do you function? You're so small, and you're made up of all these little cells that work together to form this functional creature that's no bigger than my pinky nail, which blows my mind to this day every time I think about it. But it's funny you mentioned, you know, that we talk about people not interacting with invertebrates, because they're everywhere. They're in our house. They're in our yards. You can't escape them. They're in the grills of our cars. Yet people view them as this outside entity that they don't have any sort of connection with. But they've been on this planet longer than we have. And they're probably I don't have any science to back this up, but my hunch is that they're one of the animals that people interact with the most. And I would even argue on a daily basis, we deal with invertebrates as humans, whether it be in our homes, there's a spider in the corner, or an ant on our floor. Or we think about, a lot of people talk about invertebrates in our food, right? You know, maybe you're less conscious of but how invertebrates might end up in our pantries, and not just in our pantries, like they're living there, like the factory closed some beetles in a box and put it in our, and we bought it from the grocery store, you know. Or people have that innate fear, right, of I hope there's not a spider under my bed when I reach and grab my shoe. So I think it's funny that they're viewed as outsiders when they've been with us all along.
Whether or not you kind of consciously engage with them, they are close at hand. Like, you know, they're not far away. And like you said, like an ant, you wouldn't even, if you saw an ant one day, you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I would, I'm an odd guy, but you wouldn't necessarily log that memory as like, oh, I saw, and tell someone later, I saw an ant today, in the same way you would say, I saw a horse or a
right or exactly
know. But like they're just an aspect of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Because they are so prolific and they are so ubiquitous in that sense.
Isn't that just the most interesting paradox?
It is, no, but that's precisely what's interesting, is that fact that they are simultaneously mysterious and thought of as being out of sight, whilst also being like, I think I can say this, like the majority of life on Earth is arthropod, right? Like they are just everywhere. They are just, you know, the world belongs to them essentially, but we do think of them as being distant.
They are one of the most prolific taxa until you get down to like bacteria and whatnot.
Sure.
Not to be the science person that's like, well, actually, because I get that a lot too from other science people.
We have to draw a line somewhere though. You know, people aren't. You've been studying specifically over the last however long, spiders, right? And spiders have formed the basis of your kind of academic interest.
Yes.
And I was really interested to talk to you because your study of spiders has been connected specifically to an environment, and it's an environment that I know next to nothing about, and I've tried not to learn much about it in advance of talking to you. So you've studied spiders within alvars, is that right?
Yes, yes.
So first question then, and it's one I'm sure that you spent some time answering over the course of the study, but what is an alvar?
That is one of the best questions you can ask when it comes to alvars. So the basic definition of an alvar is that it is a landscape with extremely shallow soils, only a few centimeters to, not to switch units, but a few inches deep is how we always phrase it. For us, you know, our alvar maybe went down like 4-5 inches of soil in some of the deepest places, but also in the shallowest places, there's no soil. And then underneath that soil is a limestone dolomite bedrock, which dolomite is derived from limestone. And it's just bedrock all the way down. That being said, that's a pretty loose definition.
Right.
And so then you get people asking, well, I've got shallow soil and rock in my backyard. Is that an alvar? And without going to their backyard, sometimes it is hard to say, at least where I did my research, okay. Because it is very possible people had alvar in their backyard. But I specifically worked at Red Banks Alvar State Natural Area. It is the only protected and formally recognized alvar in the state of Wisconsin, though there are arguments that other protected areas contain alvar, that there's more alvar to be found, which is almost certainly true. But there's not many alvar researchers out there, considering most people don't know what alvar is in the first place. Yeah. And so when we define alvar, to me, it's often like wetlands. I don't know if you know much about wetland discourse, but the definition of wetlands varies depending on what experts you're talking to.
Right.
And the way we categorize alvars is we separate European alvars from North American alvars. They're all still alvar, but we consider them like separate kinds of alvars. And then
right.
We break down North American alvars even further into what I worked on, which is Great Lakes alvar. I say that in quotations because to me, the only thing that ties those alvars together is that they're around the Great Lakes. But alvars are only found in 5 regions across the globe, which is Estonia, Ireland, England, Sweden, and the Great Lakes region. So working with the only formally recognized alvar in Wisconsin brought many exciting but also difficult challenges because no one's really studied Wisconsin alvar before. And right, how okay. do we connect it to these other alvars globally? Luckily, the WDNR has done half that work for me and said, yes, it's an alvar. That's the landscape you're working on. And because that's why it's a state natural area. But other than that, learning more about its ecology was on me as a researcher and specifically focusing on the spiders that live there.
An alvar is defined then by a shallow level of soil and then a kind of limestone layer beneath. So if I'm standing in the middle of an alvar environment looking around me, what am I actually seeing? It sounds like it's not a particularly, you know, I'm ignorant to these things, but it doesn't sound like a particularly easy place for things to live if it's got shallow soil and things like that.
Yeah, that's a very great comment to make, because what's cool about at least the Wisconsin alvar, and I can't speak for climate everywhere, but with shallow soils and bedrock, you've got opportunities for flooding, drought within the Midwest, freezing, you know, all within the span of 1 year. So everything that lives on the alvar must be able to withstand flooding, drought, freezing cold temperatures all throughout the year, which right. it's incredibly dynamic to go to this landscape. You know, one day it'll be like water up to my ankles, and then I come back next week and it's all gone because there's been like a heat wave and no rain, you know.
Is it a a grassland of a sort? Are there trees in Alvaz? Like what kind of plant life make up that habitat?
So the interesting thing about Alvars is you can have different Alvar types. We don't just have European and Great Lakes Alvars. Now you break it down further into Alvar grassland, Alvar shrubland, Alvar woodland. So at least at Red Banks, we've identified sort of 2-3-ish main kinds of Alvar. So we've got our Alvar grassland. So you would be surrounded by, say, prairie grasses. For those familiar, we've got like Indian grass, big blue stem, stuff like that. World milkweed or milkweed is one of the most prominent plants that I see during like the summertime. And then if you travel just in some places, if you just travel 100 meters north, you've hit this patch of woodland. So even then, these habitat patches within this habitat are small. But then the woodland, we've described our site in the woodland area as kind of a oak savanna type woodland. But then we also have another kind of woodland, which is a red cedar woodland. And you can see how this gets confusing very quickly, because we've described this larger umbrella habitat, and then you can keep breaking it up into these different kinds of things.
What's interesting to me is that, like, because we're talking about spiders,
right,
and invertebrates broadly, I guess, but this study has involved the spiders that are specifically tied to a landscape.
Right.
And when we think about, like, when we talk about spiders or we talk about ants or whatever, we tend to divide them up into their kind of their hunting styles, or into the way they build webs, or their taxonomical categories and things. So you're thinking of, is it an orb weaver, or is it a lynx spider, a wolf spider, whatever, things like that. Presumably you've now got this kind of setup where you're thinking about animals in terms of the setting they are attached to, mm-hmm. rather than necessarily specific taxonomies or species and things like that. What kind of, in terms of the spiders you're looking at, what kind of spiders then are we likely to find within that Alvar habitat you've been studying?
So I am one of a handful of people who's ever surveyed spiders on Alvars. And the funny thing is, when you have such a small group of people doing this, sometimes it is hard to say that, well, this particular species is definitely only on Alvar. I don't think there's any species that we know of yet that we can confidently say this only exists on Alvar. But what we did look at within my project is what is drawing specific either species or groups of spiders to, say, Alvar grassland versus an Alvar woodland. You know, it unfortunately ends up being that the Alvar part gets less attention because we know so little about Alvars, because so few people have looked at this specific question, what spiders live on Alvars, it becomes harder to say that the Alvar part itself necessarily plays a direct role, but it does play a role, right? Because the plant communities that take up residence on Alvars, of course, are going to host different spider communities. So the Alvar does play a role, but again, we can't confidently say this species only lives on Alvar. There is one interesting note I will make, though, is we happen to have northern black widows in Red Banks, so the Alvar I work on, which is in northern Wisconsin, Green Bay, Wisconsin. And those northern black widows are actually rare for our county. Most people wouldn't see a black widow in Brown County, Wisconsin. It's kind of like finding a shiny Pokemon kind of deal. It's super rare. But when you go to Red Banks, they seem to be everywhere. We don't have the answer to why that might be. This is my call to arachnologists everywhere and future arachnologists. These are the questions you can investigate. But we thought it was so interesting that this rare spider is seemingly populous in this one specific location in Green Bay.
When you're searching these environments, because one thing you talked about just then is the fact that you can't really be certain of anything because
right.
there's not many people doing the work and there's not many... But that appeals to me about invertebrate. It's frustrating at the same time, but one thing that does appeal is that basically you're only ever going to scratch the surface because these animals are on such a scale
mm-hmm.
compared to the scale we're talking about that you're never really going to have an actual comprehensive view of it. Is that frustrating as someone who wants to know more about the animals that live in that space?
Definitely. After I finished my project at Red Banks, I was like, well, now I want to go survey all the other alvars and see if there's similarities or differences in the spider community composition and all of that. But I recognize that the work I do is providing a foundation for other people mm-hmm. to do those kinds of studies. In my literature search, just to see how many people have done this before, there's not many other researchers who have intensively surveyed for spiders, like my advisor and I did. A lot of studies would incorporate multiple taxa, not just spiders, but like millipedes and harvestmen. And when you start incorporating mm-hmm. more and more taxa, it becomes harder to get all of those specimen identified. So you kind of get to a limited number of specimen at some point, unless, you know, you have lots of time in the world for your project, which most people, I think, would argue they don't have all the time in the world for their particular project.
You mentioned when we were talking before we started recording that you'd had to identify, was it like around 4,000 different spider species or different individual spiders? What are we talking about?
Yes. So I looked at about 4,000 plus individual spiders, both adult and juvenile. I think the number of adults was somewhere around 1,100 adults. From those adults, we identified 172 species. And then from those 172 species, actually about 20 of those species, I think the official number is 21, 21 of those we consider state records, meaning those species had never been before found in the state of Wisconsin. So that was exciting to get to do all of that. But I bet you're wondering how we identify these spiders and how we know what species they are.
It's such... You know, as someone who I think I'm really quite bad at identifying, invertebrate animals. You know, I can say with some confidence that is a orb weaver or that is a ground beetle. But as I understand it, there comes a point where you are essentially, and then you get into the question of what is a species and so on.
Yes.
Right? But then the process of actually distinguishing these creatures gets really quite nebulous and fiddly. So yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
So to identify a spider, first you need an adult spider. You cannot be sure of identification of most spiders unless you have an adult. There are some distinct spiders when they're juveniles, but again, you typically want to wait till they're an adult. Because when they reach adulthood, their reproductive organs are noticeable on their external mm-hmm. physiology. So for females, they have what we call an epiginum, which is located on the ventral part of their abdomen. And then, or their thorax, sorry. but when you look at a male, his reproductive structures are on what we call the pedipalps. So all spiders have palps, but in males, when they reach maturation, the end of their palps kind of grow. Like, we call them boxing gloves. That's typically how you hear them referred to. And then those boxing gloves have these rather, I would argue, complex structures that you can see under the microscope that are meant to help guide sperm into the female.
So you need to examine those specific structures in order to differentiate between different species.
Yes. So how I like to put it is just as every human has a unique fingerprint, every spider species has a unique vagina or pedipalp. I switch between vagina and epiginum just because it makes, I think, sense to a lot of people if you just say vagina versus epiginum.
Yeah, but it's easier to to understand. When you, like, if you have in front of you 10 spiders that you found.
Yes.
You can go really specific and you can get out the microscope and you can get out, you can whip the old vagina out and you have a look and you can say, right, that's what that is.
Yes.
But when you look at those 10 spiders that are there in front of you, presumably, or maybe not presumably, but you could say with some confidence, these ones are more closely related to this than these ones because of more obvious external characteristics and morphologies, right?
It's interesting you bring that up because there's few genetic studies on spiders. So when we look at
right.
a lot of our phylogenies are built on morphological characteristics versus genetic. But as science has found, morphology and then the genetic side of things can be really different when you try to build phylogenies off of both those things. So like the family tree, if you would, of spiders. So is species A closely related to species B or species C? So to answer your question, we can't say for sure in a lot of these cases.
Right, okay.
And it's hard for me to say with confidence, even if things look very similar, to be like, well, these crab spiders must be closely related because they look similar and they're found in the same place. It is difficult to say that because we don't have much in terms of genetics to back that up, because that tends to be kind of the way we're building phylogenies, family trees these days of species. So yeah, isn't that crazy?
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at Grubbing in the Filth, and on Twitter, it's at GITF Podcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you. What strikes me is that any study of this type, there must be a degree of, because of the level of complexity and the level of available information and just simply the your capacity, not your specific capacity, but the capacity of scientific communities to actually have data available and the time to examine these things, is that there must be a constant sense of frustration in terms of not being able to make many hard and fast statements about what it is that you're looking at. Like, you can't say, like, oh, the Alvar spider lives there. That's the kind of spider that lives there. It's the Alvar spider. It behaves in this way, and it only behaves in that way, because there is such diversity, right, within that setting.
That's the beautiful thing about arachnology work, is that there's so many unanswered questions, but to answer these questions is rather difficult, and so creativity comes in the form of experimental design if you want to try and answer some of these questions, or the beauty of copious amounts of funding, which I do not have. But it's interesting you bring up too, you know, spider behavior, because that's another thing that I've become interested in. When you look at these communities of spiders, in my thesis work, we essentially touched on the idea that specific plant communities create their own spider communities, right? The spider communities may be forming based on the plant community. Of course, there's lots and lots of factors at play, but we're specifically looking at how the plant community influences spiders. And so then you wonder, why does that spider choose to live in this particular habitat type? Whether it be alvar grassland, alvar woodlands, whether it be the degraded alvar, which has lots of invasives, what in that spider's either morphology or life history, what about it makes it prefer this space? And how does it behave within this space based off the structures that it lives around? You know, there's lots of interesting studies on spider communication. And spiders often communicate through vibrations. There's lots of interesting videos of like schizocosa like drumming their legs so that mates will hear them. And you can see this in tarantulas too. Actually, it's quite eerie when you're in a room where you hear drumming sounds on the sides of enclosures.
Right, okay.
But then you wonder, how does the environment impact those communicative signals, right? We have some spiders that love to live in leaf litter, or at least we think they love leaf litter. So are they utilizing leaf litter to send those signals? Or are the spiders utilizing, say, a live leaf versus a dead leaf? Or is there somewhere in between that's optimal for sending those vibrations? Or, you know, does their color pattern play a part? So if color pattern is important, would our most vibrant looking spiders be in more open habitats, like say a grassland? Or maybe it doesn't matter. We don't know. We'd have to test it. But again, this is why it's so exciting, because you come up with all of these questions. And I, you know, this is why I have dedicated myself to studying spiders, because there's just this endless pot of questions that I feel like are often answered in, say, mammals, but in spiders, it's so hard.
Well, let's make a mental note to consider this pot and be aware of this pot of questions, and we'll come back to that pot of questions in a moment.
Yes.
After we visit some other things. The alvar environment, you mentioned earlier that it's a very dynamic environment.
Yes.
And it might have flooding, you might have various different things that change the environment on a regular basis. And that then is presumably a challenge to the animals that live there, or rather, they need to be equipped to deal with that changing environment.
Right.
Do we see in the spiders that live in this space a kind of, presumably, again, we can't make any particularly strong statements about this, but how are the spiders that live there kind of equipped to deal with that changing environment, or any other challenges that the alvar environment throws up in particular?
I would have to say mobility would need to be on their side. But again, I can't have any confident statements, because not only do we have flooding and drought and freezing temperatures, historically, many alvars also experience burning. We think a natural occurrence in many alvars, but it can also be an unnatural occurrence, depending on the context, especially in the context of management, historical management. That's another rabbit hole. But for ease of conversation, like you mentioned, there's all of these crazy things happening that you think would make a spider feel stranded or limit, you know, what it can do in this space. There's always going to be casualties. They're prolific, right? They have lots of offspring, and those offspring tend to disperse. There's lots of neat dispersal methods. I'm sure you've heard of ballooning, where juvenile spiders will shoot like a string of web up into the air, and then wind and different electromagnetic fields will carry that, you know, young spider to a different area, and they can travel very far just by ballooning.
Like at the end of Charlotte's Web.
Right, yeah, at the end of Charlotte's Web, exactly. Yeah, again, no confident answers, but it would be interesting to see how they behave in these contexts, right? The hunch would be like, oh, there's a fire. You run away. You try to hide. Where do they hide, though, right? Is there a patch of refugia, like a patch of plants that's more fire resistant that they can kind of like go into? Is there like a log or something they can retreat to that's been untouched? Or one of our hypotheses is that the cracks in the bedrock house different species, or different species will utilize the cracks in the bedrock. But again, we don't know. That's not something we studied, but it would be interesting to know, because one thing we've considered is that some species may retreat below the freeze line in the winter into the bedrock. So when it gets really cold, the ground will freeze down to a certain point. And so we're thinking that spiders might go past that point down into the bedrock to avoid freezing to death. But who knows? I don't know. I hope someone figures it out someday.
I like how many unanswered questions there are. Again, we're conscious of that big bucket of questions we're going back to, or pot, or whatever it was. You mentioned before, you mentioned the notion of the shiny Pokemon.
Yeah.
And I guess for anyone who's not kind of generationally equipped to deal with the concept of a shiny Pokemon, we're talking about like a thing of specific value and worth among lots of other things, I guess would be a way of putting it. Like a rare thing, a shiny, a surprising and a nice surprise, right?
Yes.
Have there been, in looking for spiders, any shinies?
Yeah. So there are species that we find where we'll refer to the literature of, well, where are they normally found? Because we've never found this before in Wisconsin. These are our state records. And if we look at a map and that spider is typically found, say, more southern, we'd say, oh, this might be a range extension for this spider. Like it, now we can say the population exists further north than we once thought it was. Or now this population exists further west than we once thought it did. I think that is kind of our definition of shiny. Just those range extensions are huge.
Right.
Because the other thing we run into is we're kind of filling in a gap, right? Let's say someone found the same species to the left of us and to the right of us, but we've never found it. Well, now we've found it and we can confidently say, you know, fill in this gap. But again, those range extensions are probably some of the most exciting, because now other people can look at where the gap is and say, well, do we have this spider now? Or maybe the spider traveled there somehow by human means or some unnatural means. I want to add that there are species to me that I personally would call them shinies that when I put them under the scope, they just take my breath away. And they are, you know, a species that might be rare or never been found before in the state. And a lot of that can be chalked up to, well, you find a lot of spiders where there's arachnology. It's kind of the problem we run into. But one particular species that I fell in love with in my work was Vulcanaria pinocchio. And you can imagine, yes, by its name, it's got pinocchio-like features.
Is it a spider that lives inside a whale? Or that has a Italian stepfather?
So, and the image I sent you is one I took under the microscope. I remember just the shock I felt in my heart.
This is the reaction.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So this is your photo. So to describe it, we have what looks to be, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, like a side view of the main body of the spider.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm presuming, because I can see the palps, that's the front.
Yes.
And we have a protuberance, right?
Yes.
Is that what gets where the name comes from?
Yes, Vulcanaria pinocchio. It essentially looks like either a unicorn horn kind of deal or a pinocchio nose, which is where it gets its name from. And as you can see, its eyes are at the base of that, we'll call it pinocchio nose, but we don't know what it's used for. It's definitely not a nose like you and I have. The spiders don't smell like we do. So to call it a nose would be incorrect. But we don't know what it uses that projection for. Which again is why this field is so exciting. You see these crazy modifications on spiders and you wonder why they have that. And no one has been able to answer that question yet. And it's incredible how often that comes up.
It's interesting to me that you mentioned that the point at which you encounter the shiny is under a microscope.
Right.
So you're not... Maybe you could talk me through what is the actual process of finding a spider?
Yeah. So I'll mention first that Pinocchio spider is maybe only 2 millimeters large. It's very, very small.
Right,
you would never see it out in the wilds or recognize it in the wilds. If you can, you're a superhuman and I would like to meet you. But the process of searching for spiders, first we have to develop our collection protocols. And this can vary from researcher to researcher, from project to project, depending on what exactly you want to collect. Like if I wanted to collect spiders in trees versus spiders on the ground. But for my particular project, we wanted to collect everything and anything we could in terms of spiders. So we did two specific kinds of methods. And the first method is pitfall trapping. So we bury pee cups in the ground. If you've ever taken like a urine test, we bury those flush with the ground. And then we fill it with solution that compromises the individuals when they fall in, unfortunately. But I do, yeah. I have a lot of gratitude for these animals as well when, you know, they come into our traps. Unfortunately, they lose their life. But I'm so extremely grateful that their life goes towards, you know, something so... It goes towards building all of these questions and helping the world learn. So we bury these pee cups in the ground. They fall in, but not just spiders fall in. Everything falls in. We try to prevent mammals from getting into our traps by putting bitterant in it. So it tastes bad to mammals. Some will eat it anyways. I don't know why. they each individual has a different palate, I guess.
Of course.
But once all of my animals have fallen in, I let that trap sit for about a week. And then I go into the field, I pick it up, and then I take it back to the lab. And then I have to separate spiders from non-spiders. So is it a spider? Yes, it goes in one pile. Spider, no, it goes in a different pile. And I only care about my spiders. Once I've gotten all my spiders, then I have to start identifying each of the spiders. And that process ends up looking like me identifying the families I know best first. So if there's, I usually start from the biggest families to the smallest too, in terms of body size. So like wolf spiders, I typically identify first. And then I'll go down to maybe Nephosids, which are another kind of ground spider, to all the way down to the last I usually identify is Linophiids, which are the smallest spiders you can find typically. And a lot of people actually end up passing over Linophiids when they're identifying things because they can be really difficult to identify. They're really small. You need a really good microscope. So if you don't have a good microscope, it might be impossible to identify some of these spiders. And I make that process sound like it's quick, but this is hours over months. Even just sorting spiders from non-spiders takes days, weeks, you know, because we get a lot of samples. And then identifying the spiders themselves, if it's a new identification for me, you know, from keying it out to dissecting, some species will take me 2 hours to identify one individual. So when you imagine 4,000 spiders, this takes a very, very long time, especially to someone who's never had to identify spiders in that way before. I mean, my advisor, I so look up to him because I feel like I give him a spider and he's like, oh, yeah, I know what this is. And then he'll, you know, search through the literature really fast and he knows exactly what it is. But it took me a very, very long time. And to get to that level of expertise that my advisor has takes decades of work, you know.
I guess it speaks to the kind of the fact that you are looking at such small creatures and you are looking at so many creatures and the fact that all this is happening within a relatively rare environment and a relatively small amount of space in terms of the global picture.
Right.
It speaks to diversity of life as a broader theme, right?
Isn't that just incredible though?
Well, absolutely. To kind of to illustrate, because you were mentioning some of them there, but obviously in the world there's a lot of spiders and those spiders are very, very diverse, and it makes sense that they're diverse because some of those spiders live in jungles and some of those spiders live in temperate climates or in these extremely disparate landscapes. But you've been studying your own little world, this Alvar environment.
Yeah.
And within that specific environment, is there a way of kind of exemplifying the diversity within that setup? How diverse are the spiders you're finding?
So we do have diversity metrics. I guess I'm going to backtrack a little bit to illustrate just how many spiders exist in a small location. So we do a method called rapid assessment protocol, where our goal is to get every single spider species within a within like a, what is it, a 1 point, like almost 5 meter radius. So we've got this like circle, right?
Right.
And we're trying to get
a relatively small space, but not for a spider.
Right. So as we're sampling this space, we're using sweep nets. So like a bug net, and we're sweeping through all the vegetation. Mm-hmm. We're using litter sifters to see what spiders fall out of the litter. We're using beading sheets where we're hitting vegetation and hoping spiders fall out. And we're collecting every single spider possible with these devices, affectionately called pooters or aspirators. Yeah. And we suck up those spiders, and I call it a professional straw, and that's how we collect them. And in one round of collecting, you can find, you know, over 100 spiders. They won't all be adults, of mm-hmm. course, but you can find so many spiders in just that tiny little space. Yeah. So it's incredible to me to see that reflected in our data. You know, I did the collecting, and now I can see what all we got in that tiny little space. So that, I think, is a good illustration of how many spiders exist within a small area. But when we talk about actual diversity metrics, we tend to measure things. The most popular is Shannon's diversity and Simpson's diversity. And not to get too into specifics, but essentially both of those metrics tell us how diverse is a space. And you pick, most people use Shannon's, but I know some people will use Simpson's if it's a relatively known diverse habitat, like tropical habitats, right? Some researchers will use Shannon's for tropical habitats because of the influence of rare species on the analysis. But I'm going into the weeds a little bit here. But
that's all right. You explore the weeds.
But essentially, like I said, those metrics tell us how diverse is the Alvard. So I did perform those metrics. And based on those metrics, yes, it's diverse by that analysis. Mm-hmm. But to know if all alvars are diverse, we would have to do that across all alvars. So again, we can't confidently say that for sure alvars host diverse communities of spiders. My hunch is yes, if our particular habitat is hosting this incredible community of spiders. I mean, 171 species, 71, 72 is a lot to find in one place.
Yeah.
But again, that also depends on intensity of sampling, you know, identification, accuracy, all of those kinds of things. So again, it gets tricky. Do you see what I'm getting at here? It can be difficult to say if a place is really diverse in spiders or not, because there's a lot of factors at play.
I guess also for you as like an academic and a arachnologist, as opposed to me, who's just like a man that likes spiders a bit. Like your sense of what diversity means is quite distinct from mine, because when I'm just thinking, are the big ones and small ones? Are the ones that have webs, are the ones that run on the ground? Like, it's interesting for me to know that quite how much thought and how much, you know, there are metrics for these things, as opposed to it being kind of an impression one gets.
And I think, too, you can get impressions. I think that's doable in, say, like plant species. If you're standing in the middle of a habitat and you look around, that's very visible to you. But the beautiful thing about spiders is you have no idea what's under your feet, when the smallest of them can be half a millimeter large.
Hard to get your head around the fact that something that small can even have like internal organs and can possibly operate in roughly the same way as one of the bigger spiders. It's, you know, it's internally it's going to look similar, if not not the same, obviously. But
my favorite question right now is, how do these small spiders even find each other in these habitats to be able to mate and reproduce? Mm. You know, when we think about the Pinocchio spider, there's almost zero information on it and its behavior and its ecology, all of that. We just know what it looks like and some of the places it's found. And that's so exciting for me. I would love to investigate Pinocchio spiders more, but that also involves having to find them. And globally, they're kind of a rare find. Granted, you need a linophied person or someone who can identify spiders to tell you what it is. So maybe mm-hmm. people have Pinocchio spiders in their sample sets, but don't know it. But even amongst linophied people, it's rare to find, I think especially the males, because the females don't have that projection. So again, that begs the question, why does he have it? Why doesn't he have it? Is it a mating thing? Is it a hunting thing? I don't know. I really want to know. I'm dying to know.
You can now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast, but you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. Having looked, because I'm, again, for the listener, behind you I can see a number of tanks. And I know that there are spiders and cockroaches and various beasts knocking around in your vicinity, as there are in mine. But for you, because insects and invertebrates are so prolific, inevitably there's something nearby, right? But for you, you have containers and things. And I'm wondering if going out and exploring wild spaces and conducting surveys of wild spaces and searching these areas, and having to think about specific landscapes and things, has that had any kind of impact or crossover in terms of how you view the sort of micro landscapes that you've built for your spiders that live with you?
Right. So my first thought in regards to this question is, seeing animals in their natural habitat to me is more rewarding than having them, say, in a tank. But the other thing, the converse to that is, not everyone gets that opportunity, right? So there is sort of a reason why one might keep invertebrates in tanks. And so one of my formal roles and informal roles is being an outreach specialist, a science communicator. So having these animals, to be able to talk to people about them, is very important, because like I said, not everyone gets the opportunity to go outside and to see these animals. So I want to be able to bring the animals to them and meet them where they're physically at, so that they can experience some of that in their own space. For example, most of the species I have are exotic species. They're considered non-native to the United States. So most people in the U.S. would never encounter these animals in the wild. But I can bring my animals to those people to be able to meet those animals and to get to know them and to understand, you know, the larger scale to which invertebrates exist.
Do you think that's I say this knowing the answer, but I was just going to say, do you think that's an important thing to do? But of course you do, and I agree with you. But why do you think it is important that people have the opportunity to spend time with invertebrate animals?
I have a lot of answers firing off in my brain at once. And, you know, we touched on this in our pre-discussion. And I guess my first thought is, it's important because people are often scared of invertebrates. And I think that's part of why I love your podcast so much, is that it brings people closer to invertebrates in a way that they may not have anticipated. And that's my goal, is to bring people closer to them, because I think once you get to know them, you'll feel better about them. And one of my favorite quotes, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but have you ever seen Adventure Time? It's a children's cartoon.
It loomed large about 10 years ago.
Yes. Okay, so there's a character. His name is Jake the dog. He's a talking dog. Mm-hmm. And in this one particular episode, they're being haunted by this like this ghost, basically. And his roommate, Finn, is freaking out. And he's going, oh my gosh, this is so like scary and weird and creepy. And Jake goes, like, that which we call weird and creepy are things we just don't understand. And that has always stuck with me. And that's kind of the quote I carry with me to classrooms and to outreach programs, is that when we call things weird and creepy and scary, I think we just haven't had time to get to know them yet. And so that's why I want people to meet these animals and to interact with them. Because that's how I got over my fear. I used to be afraid of spiders, actually. Nice. Regretfully, but also there's no shame in it. I always tell people, if you're scared of spiders, that's 100% okay. It's incredibly common and natural to be scared of them. So when I was afraid, I think it was because I didn't understand them. I thought that they would bite me, that they would hurt me, that while I was asleep, they were going to crawl in my mouth or something. I probably just gave someone goosebumps. But once I got to know them through my work, suddenly all those things I thought were untrue. That learning about invertebrates, I think almost 100% of the time, makes them less scary. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but I feel like that's kind of a general theme that I find.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I think even if what you're discovering is, because there are, when you learn about the natural world, sometimes you're learning about things that are, like, to our sensibilities, horrific in terms of, like, how things hunt, or in terms of, like, quite how brutal the natural world can be. But I think that, I do think you're right, and I think that knowing more about something could never be a bad thing. So to discover the invertebrate world and to make it make more sense, even if it becomes more impressive, or it becomes, or you become aware of its the kind of the grisly side of it, it does strip away the fear of the unknown, right? Which is in many ways what we actually are talking about when we're talking about fear of insects, or fear of, I always say insects, it's just the word.
Okay, I know what you mean.
Fear of, because we are scared of things we don't understand. I think also with fear of invertebrates, we're often, what frightens us is a sense of intrusion, in a sense that things that we have kind of sacred space around us, that we don't want what we perceive as wild to be in that space. You know, you wouldn't put up with a dog in your house that you didn't know. You wouldn't put up with a cow, you know, whatever. and so why wouldn't a spider or a fly or whatever in your home be a scary thing? And then that extends to the outside world, and we want to sanitize outdoor spaces, and we want to,
right,
and we become frightened of these things. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I feel like humans have we've removed ourselves from nature. We don't consider ourselves part of nature. And I think a lot of times, objectively, we aren't, I think we are and we aren't part of nature in a sense, in terms of we have created this unnatural management of landscape through the building of cities and whatnot, but we are still part of nature and we have an impact on it. And, you know, as you touched on, I think people view their home as not part of nature. Nature is not allowed inside where there shouldn't be nature, because that's sort of the boundary that humans have drawn for themselves. And, you know, I'm generalizing here, so hopefully no one's offended and saying, I let them in.
I think it's a fair generalization, yeah.
Right. But the thing is, nature has no boundaries. And the spiders don't recognize borders or lines, or, you know, your house as not a part of nature. It views it as shelter, as a place to hunt, which maybe that sounds scary to some people, but to me, I welcome them. I have lots of free-range spiders that I didn't personally invite. They invited themselves, but I'm glad they're here.
Sure.
And that, you know, as we talked about before too, invertebrates are everywhere, yet somehow we've developed this sense of they're foreign to us. They're not part of our everyday lives, even though they are. They're always there, whether it's like we talked about the spider in the corner of your basement, or it's, you know, the fly in your kitchen. They're everywhere. You're always in close proximity to invertebrates. And again, maybe that's scary to some people, but it is something to consider when it comes to how we view the natural world and our role in it.
Julian, thank you so much for talking to me about spiders and alvars and all these wonderful big concepts, and it's such a overwhelmingly interesting topic just to kind of to touch on the diversity of spiders and on what it's meant to you as a spider professional. But you'll recall we had that big bucket of questions, that jar.
You're right.
Whatever it was a container of questions. And you did mention about actually this question of how are the smallest spiders finding each other? Because what's weird is that, tell me if this makes sense, because it might not make sense. Like, we talked about Pokemon before, right? And you have like media franchises, and you have this notion of the lore of a story, and like, and when the new Star Wars film comes out, people are saying, oh, we might get to find out what happened between this event and this event, and this, these. And I think that sometimes when I think about invertebrate life, or when I think about the natural world, I almost find myself thinking about it in the same way that I might think about something that is less real and is an imagined thing, because like, nature is this huge thing and it's completely unknowable. And I don't know where Obi-Wan Kenobi is from. Maybe that's been disclosed, I don't know. But like, that is a thing that is either the information exists or it doesn't. And when someone decides where he's from, we know. I may have gone off on a weird tangent here, but my point is that your Pinocchio spider, we don't know how the Pinocchio spider finds its mate, but it does. Like, that, the answer exists. It's just that we can't get it yet. And the answer won't start existing when we decide that we have that information. Like, however it does it, it's doing it right now.
Right.
And what that has quite to do with Obi-Wan Kenobi, I'm not entirely sure, but like, hopefully someone listening will kind of get what I mean. But the answers are out there. There are, like, because this is a real thing, it's not a fiction. Any questions we have about spiders, there is an answer, if that makes sense. Because of course there is, because they exist and they're real. As such, there's a barrel of questions. If there was a question, you could kind of, you know, magic wand time, you could just know the answer.
Oh gosh.
About spiders, about the invertebrate world at large, I guess. But is there a question that you would, that you'd wish we had the answer to?
You know, I became a researcher because I like working to answer those questions. So I feel like, you know, waving a wand and knowing the answer removes
it takes the fun out of it.
Removes my fun. But it would be nice, wouldn't it, to just know. And I feel like maybe I would, if I had, you know, a magic wish, maybe it would be some of those larger questions that we would probably never get the answer to, like, are there any spider species that live only on alvars and nowhere else, any kind of habitat, which we likely will never know the answer to that.
No.
Those are the kinds of questions I think I would wish for. But the kinds that we can actively work towards, I would be excited to do those in research, like finding Pinocchio spiders, putting them in a, you know, lab setting to see how they behave, or, you know, finding one and then putting it back in the wild, seeing if we can see how it behaves in a natural setting. But maybe it runs off too fast for us to be able to observe it again. I don't know. But again, that's the fun.
This magic wand set. It's good to hear that. It's good to hear that is the part of the fun, though, because yeah, it's exciting that there are unanswered questions, I think, and I'm glad there's people like you that are working to find out the answers, and then inevitably those answers will breed more questions, and so on, and on we go. Right?
I think, you know, my next project will just be Star Wars: The New Frontier. You know, right. Trying to,
maybe it will,
you know, answering questions from previous, you know, events, but adding more to the pot.
Got you. Yeah, that's a very nice way of putting it. Well, Gillian, again, thank you so much for speaking with me. We might want to cut this bit up because I don't know if you're happy with that or not. But are there any if people want to kind of engage more with what you do in terms of science communication and things like that, is there any way you want to kind of push people towards?
I encourage people to create what I call a science Twitter, where you can follow lots of different scientists and you're essentially, you know, narrowing your algorithm down to science-based things or science communication. Okay. If people are interested in my particular science communication, you can find me at Bugs or Bus on Twitter. But there are so many incredible scientists and specifically science communicators out on Twitter who just do a beautiful job of explaining different scientific concepts, new published studies. They post their figures or their papers in a way that's digestible to everyone. And I think a lot of the scientific community is extremely open to people asking them questions. We just have to make that connection with each other. So I hope people would go out of their way to find scientists they enjoy, who they're interested in, and find a way to connect with them. You don't necessarily have to DM them, but even just interacting with their feed or asking questions, that's what we're here for, is to have those discussions with each other. You know, it's not just the scientific community. I think of understanding nature, a global community. It's not just the work of scientists, it's the work of everybody.
Well put. And a nice thing for me to hear as well, as someone who's kind of trying to snake his way into the community and to do his own little bit. But yeah, good answer. But Jillian, thank you so much. I'll let you get on with your day. Does your day involve any invertebrate adjacent activities?
Well, I just got two baby jumping spiders and they are in need of a habitat, I guess a home makeover is what I should say. So that'll be one of my duties for the day, is performing jumping spider renovations so that they have somewhere to build their webs.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for talking to me, and give my best to the jumping spiders. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so thank much, you. Tom.
Grubbing in the Filth is written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hatton. And thanks again to Gillian Sokrowski-Legree. You can find Grubbing in the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast or Instagram at Grubbing in the Filth. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.